Want to try a free sample?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
You only eat after you're walking 10,000 steps.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Signos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Signos.com. Signos.com with code SPARK. Signos.
Sick of procurement bottlenecks, endless back and forth, and last-minute surprises? Get the cure with Bill Procurement. Bill is the all-in-one platform trusted by nearly 500,000 businesses to simplify and automate their financial operations. And now they've introduced Bill Procurement, which pairs seamlessly with accounts payable to automate procure-to-pay workflows in one place. Every step, from submitting a purchase request to reconciling payment, happens in Bill Procurement. You'll know whether spend is approved before you buy, and Bill's AI-powered automation helps reduce errors so you can make purchasing decisions with confidence. Plus, Bill Procurement puts everything you need to match and pay invoices right at your fingertips. So dump your clunky procurement process and keep your business moving and growing with Bill Procurement. Purchase, pay, and on with your day. Right now, score $200 when you see Bill Procurement in action with a demo. Just go to bill.com/procurement200. Don't wait. That's bill.com/procurement200.
Hello, everyone. This is Heikki Kovalainen, and you're listening to Beyond the Grid podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome once again to your favorite corner of podcast land, Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. Here's hoping that you're all fit and well and ready to hear from another cracking guest. Because this week, I'm chatting to a man who was hugely popular back in the day for his relaxed, easygoing persona, Heikki Kovalainen. And he was no slouch either. Heikki won the 2008 Hungarian Grand Prix. But that was to be his only win in a career that spanned 111 races for Renault, McLaren, Caterham and Lotus. His talent probably deserved to win more races, but for various reasons, which we look into in this extremely fascinating and candid chat, that didn't happen. It wasn't the machinery at his disposal, at least when he was at McLaren, because his teammate Lewis Hamilton won the world championship in the same MP4-23. The thing is, except for that win in Hungary, which Heikki inherited after Felipe Massa retired late in the race, he rarely got the rub of the green. Yes, in this business you often make your own luck, but if there was bad luck to be had, Heikki was usually on the receiving end. And throughout his Formula One career, there were management issues and all sorts of other drains on his energy and focus. Yet Heikki makes no excuses. His sense of perspective is remarkable, and he remains one of the most articulate and unassuming drivers ever to sit in a Formula One car. And don't forget that he was bloody quick on his day. His pole lap at Silverstone in 2008 was one of the great laps of that season, and a reminder to Lewis Hamilton and the like of his fabulous speed. These days, Heikki races GTs in Japan, but he lives in Finland and sunny Abu Dhabi. We caught up remotely and he regaled me with fascinating tales about what it was like to be teammates with arguably the best driver of all time. That massive Spanish Grand Prix crash he had in 2008, why his Formula One career took the twists and turns that it did, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Heikki, it's great to see you via Zoom. You're looking very well. Where in the world are you at the minute?
Well, in fact, now I've spent the last few weeks here in North Finland. We've got a small cottage in the middle of the forest here. And I was, in fact, preparing for my Super GT season in Japan already. Things were still going ahead there. But then eventually the start of the season got postponed. And the only place that I could return, or maybe not the only place, but in one of my homes is in Finland, and this was the only home at the time that I could return, because our normal residence, which is in Abu Dhabi, was already in lockdown, so I couldn't return there. So I got back here, and in fact, it's not too bad place to be. It's very quiet here. It's very easy to distance myself from everyone, and I can still do some activities outside and relatively normal cottage life. So it's not too bad place to be during this time.
Sounds amazing. Now, before we go on, you've got a picture on the wall behind you.
Yeah.
It looks like a mid-70s McLaren. I'm guessing an M23?
Yeah, it's possible. It's James Hunt 76. So perhaps that was the McLaren at that time. Yeah, it's
The one who won the championship.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah, it's it's a friend of mine who's making these sprints and this kind of artwork. He asked me a while ago to pick one as a souvenir from him to me, and I picked this one. Not because of James Hunt, although I'm a fan of Hunt, I'm not that big fan. But in fact, the Mount Fuji on the background in that artwork is the reason why I picked that. Fuji is a special place for me in Japan. First time I ever went to Japan as a test driver for the Renault team in 2006 was we went to Fuji and we had a nice event there with some of the sponsors. My first podium in Formula One. 2007 happened at Fuji, and also my first podium in Super GT in 2016 was at Fuji. So that's the reason why I picked that picture. Isn't a very nice artwork? Yeah,
this is lovely. Well, let's talk about your Formula One career now in more detail. And I want to start, if I may, by taking you back to Silverstone 2008. You're in your first year with McLaren alongside Lewis Hamilton. And I think I witnessed one of the best qualifying laps I've ever seen. You put the car on pole by half a second. I think Webber was alongside you on the grid. Hamilton was back in fourth. Was that the best lap of your Formula One career?
Well, it's hard to say whether it was the best lap, but it was a good one. I think one of the good ones at that weekend. In fact, all weekend was looking quite strong for me. The practice sessions on Friday, I was right near the top, if not on top on both sessions on Friday. The car felt good, the tyres felt good, everything felt fine. And the qualifying day, I remember it was a really windy day. And then some of the corners, a lot of guys were struggling, in fact, to put a good lap together. And I think also Lewis, on his best lap, he was caught by a gust of wind in one of the corners. It was towards the end of the lap. I can't remember exactly which corner, but I think he lost more time. And the gap to Lewis was bigger than it perhaps should have been. But you know, having said that, I think I had legs that weekend for Lewis. I was looking strong that weekend, so it was a good lap, and of course a good opportunity for me to take my first pole. Shame it was the only one, but at least some good memories. Yeah,
Pedro de la Rosa, who was the test driver that year with you guys, yeah, says it was one of the best laps he's ever seen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I remember the engineers, my race engineer Mark Slade, and the whole McLaren team. Obviously, they were very happy about that, and Mark was telling me, you know, it was really good lap, and you know, he was obviously very pleased for that. It didn't feel that special. That just that weekend, every session felt relatively comfortable for me, and even that qualifying, I remember after I'd done the lap, it didn't feel like super lap inside the car. It felt tidy and good lap, but didn't feel like super lap. Like sometimes you feel like, wow, that felt really good. But the time was really good. And I think I managed the conditions that day better than anyone there on the grid.
Can you talk to me about how you used to prepare yourself for a qualifying lap and the sort of the pressure and how different your approach was to qualifying compared to the race?
I guess it was somewhat different. I used to do quite a lot of I don't know what you call it in English, but like mentally preparing. I was going through the lap in my head.
Visualization.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, visualization. I've done that, in fact, all the way through my career. I did that before I got into the garage in my little room while I was sitting in the car, and I was kind of going through the lap. And I've done that quite a lot. For the race, it's slightly different. It's very hard to prepare for the race. The race start always is so unpredictable and so difficult to plan that it's almost better not to plan it, and it's just let your instinct and go with your your instinct and let your body make the choices and the subconscious mind make the choices for you in the race. But in the qualifying, I think the preparation for me at least was useful, and I still do that in the GT races as well. So I remember before the qualifier, after the third practice session, sitting in my room going through the lap and through the breaking points and kind of like, you know, trying to picture that that lap in my head. And I think the qualifying, in fact, has never been such a big problem. I've always been relatively good qualifier. So maybe it's something that's worked reasonably well over my career.
So Heikki, in the race at Silverstone, you start on pole. Cut a long story short, you finish fifth, and your teammate drives one of the races of his career and wins the race wet, etc., etc. In a funny kind of way, does that weekend slightly sum up your 2 years at McLaren in that it's sort of promised so much and yet ultimately turned out to be a little bit frustrating? Is that how you view those 2 years?
Yeah, I think it's quite well said. And it's the truth, really. Actually, the first year at McLaren started really well in Melbourne. I qualified third. And in fact, in the race, in my first race with McLaren, without the safety car, I think my strategy at that point would have been very good. I had a chance to jump Lewis, or at least jump, I think it was Robert in front of me, and probably finish second or third in that race, if not win the first race. And then after the first few races, I think I was ahead of Lewis in the points. But things didn't eventually then work out as planned. So yeah, I think you're right. It kind of sums up that there was some promise, and I had some momentum going to McLaren. My first year at Renault started really poor, but I managed to turn the season around. And at the end of the 2007 season, things were starting to click and started to work. And I started to make some decent results. And I was ahead of Fizzy most of the time. So I had the momentum. The momentum continued at the beginning of 2008 season, but I didn't manage to ride the wave all the way, if you like. And then second half of 2009 season, it fell apart. That's probably a good way to describe it. I think there are many reasons for it. Ultimately, it just didn't work out.
What about Lewis Hamilton? I mean, I would put a pretty strong argument to you that had you had any other teammate in 2008, I think the might have been different. Just tell us about the relationship with Lewis, particularly in that first season. And also, let's celebrate Lewis. I mean, what makes him such a phenomenon?
Yeah, I mean, I had a great 2 years with Lewis as a teammate. We've never had any big problems with us. And perhaps one reason that we've always gotten on very well is I'd never really challenged him like seriously enough, perhaps. He'd never got enough of a challenge that, you know, he needed to stretch. But in fact, I felt the both years there, it was hard for me. He was just that tiny bit faster all the time, and I had to stretch every session. It was straight from the winter test. You know, I was always like, I had to stretch to match him or be ahead of him. Like an average lap wasn't good enough. And when you've done that for a year and a half, I kind of run out of energy. And the second half of the second year in 2009 in McLaren, it's fair to say that I drove below my own ability even. Rather than focusing on my own race and my own results and trying to get close to Lewis, you know, I started to overdrive and getting frustrated. And in fact, the gap just got bigger and I made some mistakes. But I think the reason why that happened during that second half of 2009 was because I had to stretch all the time. And when you're stretching for too long time, you run into a wall at some point. And I think that's what happened. I think it's just his pace was just a tiny bit quicker consistently. I don't have any trouble admitting it. You know, he's one of the greatest, if not the greatest driver. So I'm glad I went against him. But at that point of my career, it was also quite detrimental for my career. I had a bit of momentum, but I wasn't able to keep the momentum going with Lewis as my teammate.
This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low-impact motion. And I don't need to second-guess my progress because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout.
The ARC uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro ARC, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the ARC. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID.
Is Lewis the kind of guy who has to be fastest in every session?
Yeah, I think he is. And I think that's one of the reasons why he is so great. He's got unbelievable fighting spirit in himself. You know, we had some funny things sometimes we did. And I mean, he took even like a small bets very seriously. For example, at Spa, I think in 2009, we were at Spa and the first practice was just about to start. And I think Lewis came to me and said that, would you like to do a bet just on the outlap that... who goes faster through a rouge straight out of the box? And because those days it wasn't like easy flat out straight out of the box on Friday morning. And I said, yeah, we'll do that. And I mean, he just went with the right leg straight, and he went flat out the first lap. And I had a tiny lift, and I lost the bet. But that was kind of thing that I kind of knew that that's a lost money for me. I was never gonna win that. So. Yeah, he's got unbelievable fighting spirit.
That is fantastic. Did you have lots of bets? Is he quite like that? Or was it just that one occasion?
Not a lot of bets, but I remember that particular one we did, and the engineers found out that afterwards, and they were like, my engineer was like, what are you doing? You know, it's not like risking everything, you know, Friday morning. And I mean, I was lifting and he wasn't. So I was like, he's risking more.
Heikki, where is he particularly impressive? Is it under braking, or seems to be there's obviously so much time to be made up there, but also is it through fast stuff? Is there one particular area?
Yeah, I think the main area that I struggled to match him was braking areas. So he was able to brake later and harder, and yet he was able to hit the apex and make the exit the same as mine. Generally, his lines were a bit more square than mine, so he braked late and deep the car in quite a short distance, and then his exits were quite straight. And I think that's one of the reasons over the years that he's been able to look after tires also very well. He puts less energy into the tires, and when he puts the energy, he puts them in places that it hurts the tires less. Like I was loading the tires, I was making corners quite long, and that's kind of my driving style. And I remember at McLaren, the engineers were also saying the Fernando style a bit similar, Kimi style and Mika style, they all carry a lot of speed into the corner and they make corners very long, whereas Lewis, he arrives, brakes late, turns the car sharp and has a straighter exit, so the tire has less energy. And I remember that particular area, the braking areas, were always where I was struggling against him. So I think that's one of the key areas where he's very good. I remember in the high speed stuff, I was able to match him like minimum speeds in the high speed corners. That wasn't that hard. It was easier to match him. But the braking areas and low-speed corners, he's very good at driving when the car doesn't have the maximum aero load and the car is moving around a bit more and you're kind of sitting on the mechanical grip and on the tire grip, if you like. He's very good at, he's got some special sensors in his ass that he can just tiptoe on that edge just a bit beyond everyone else, I think.
Are you friendly with Valtteri, just out of interest?
Yeah, I am friendly with Valtteri, yeah.
Were you able to give him any pointers when he joined Mercedes?
No, I mean, not really. I mean, he's never asked me anything. Of course, if he ever asked, I could talk to him. Only a few times I've spoken to him after some Grand Prix during his first year. I think it was a Mercedes. He had a few races where he was struggling with tire wear more than Lewis, and especially rear tires. He was unable to keep the soft tire alive as well as Lewis. And I remember we talked, I think it was after Bahrain, maybe his first year Mercedes, and after Bahrain we talked about that, and I was telling him my experience about Lewis. I said, you know, just pay attention, he's braking and he's kind of low speed style, if you like, keep an eye on that, because that's where he's really strong. And I think Valtteri agreed with that, but I haven't given him any tips. I think he can figure it out himself, and he's done very well over the years, I thought. But yeah, we've had small chats every now and then.
Spain 2008, you've just taken the lead of the race, and then you have a front left wheel rim failure at, what, 150 miles an hour, I guess, turn nine at Barcelona. Huge accident.
Yeah.
Horrible to watch. I think you were buried under the tyre barrier, weren't you?
Yeah.
First of all, let's talk about the crash, actually. How much warning did you get of that rim failure? And can you remember what you thought as you were heading towards the barrier?
Yeah. In fact, I can't remember the whole incident. I remember starting the lap. I think it was maybe Robert was in front of me and he pitted. And I think I had, out of the guys at the top, I had the most fuel. So I had a couple of laps extra on everyone. And I remember engineer telling me, okay, now it's time to push and turn up the engine a bit and trying to make a bit of time before our stop. Then I have a 4-hour blackout getting back to this world at hospital with Ron there. And I think Marty was there and my wife was there. And I don't remember anything about that. But yeah, I think there was no warning. Just looking back, looking at some of the footage, and you know, there was no warning. The wheel nut was just coming off during that first stint. There was some lacquer coating being left between the wheel and the nut, and the nut wasn't fully tightened at the start of the race, and it came off just a couple of laps too early. I mean, had I stopped lap or two earlier, would have probably not happened. But yeah, it happened in the worst place. Obviously, it always happens in the highest speed corner, and there was no way to escape that. So it was a big hit, and I hit my head under the car, sort of slid under the barrier, and I hit my head into the barrier, and that would knock me out. But I mean, there was no other damage, just a hit in the head and a bit of a concussion.
Interesting that you say Ron Dennis was there when you came round.
Yeah, yeah, he was there, and obviously everyone was worried. You know, it kind of looked when I went under the barrier and my head got a hit. I think you never know if the whole head is being chopped off. You know, it looked quite bad. Fortunately, you know, nothing more than that happened. Just a hit in my head. And yeah, I stayed in Spain for a week, just as precautionary checks, and then yeah, I went back home, and then I think it was a couple of weeks later we were Istanbul. So,
do you think in hindsight you were ready to race in the Turkish Grand Prix?
I think I was ready. Yeah, I had some headaches, but all the other sort of neurological tests that I did with the doctors, they were all normal. So I think I was ready, and in fact I qualified very well there. In fact, my engineer told me again there that we need to hit you in the head more often, because it seems like the performance been really good. I think I qualified on the front row with the two-stop strategy. Most of the guys won a three-stop strategy, so we were really looking strong for the race. And then just Kimi touched me in the first corner, I got a puncture and the race fell apart. But I think physically and mentally, I was ready to race. Yeah, there was no issues with that.
What about the dangers, just out of interest, particularly in Formula One? How did you come to terms with the dangers of the sport? And of course, you know, we'll come and talk about your win in Hungary, but of course, Felipe Massa as well and his accident. Do you think about that much?
No.
Even after the crash in Spain, did it make you question things more? Or
no, it didn't.
Mad racing driver.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, many people ask about this, and I mean, I've never thought about it and never worried about it. Once I get into a race car, at least up to this point of my career, I'm still committed and still not even thinking about the dangers and risks. I think when the day comes that I start thinking about it, it's time to stop. I think you can't afford to be afraid of it and worrying about it too much. Oh, in fact, worrying about it at all. I think it's not possible to race hard and race well and being worried about it. But maybe that day will arrive one day. And I'm getting older. I'm getting towards the end of my career, I'm sure. The end is closer than the beginning, I'm sure. So
Nah, you're only 38, Heikki. You're only 38.
yeah, but you know, yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, maybe you can still race a few years, but I've been racing since very many years ago. So I'm sure that at some point the end will come. But so far, at least, I haven't been worried. I haven't worried about these kind of things, and I've never thought about it. People ask about it, and just say I've never even considered, never even thought about that. So
I'm interested. You say that you did some neurological tests after Barcelona. I'm quite interested to know what they were. How much can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we did I think the sort of basic kind of tests, some memory tests, some coordination tests, and I think there are many different protocols that you can do, and I had to do a lot of. I don't think I had to do, but the doctor McLaren at that time wanted me to do all these things and just to check. So I mean, they scanned all the brains, all the CT scans, and everything were fine. Still, they wanted to check that all the neurological and sort of your neurological skills have stayed the same. And then before the Istanbul, I also had to do the official FI test, which is kind of similar things. There's some memory things and some kind of puzzles that you have to pass. And the doctor, Gary Hartstein, he said, you're good to go. So they were all fine.
And I'm guessing Gary and the McLaren doctor, was it Aki Hintze?
Yeah.
I imagine they'd already spoken as well.
Yeah, they'd already spoken. And Aki was confident. He said to me that from what he's seen, he's happy for me to race if I feel like racing. And yeah, of course, I felt like racing. I felt fine. Just a little bit of headaches. Still, before the Istanbul weekend, I had some small headaches, but they said it was normal after that kind of big impact. It was quite a big concussion, quite a long kind of blackout. So it takes a while, but all the other signs were good. So there was no danger. There was nothing to worry about otherwise.
Aki very sadly passed away a couple of years ago, didn't he? But
yeah.
How much of an influence did he have on you and your career?
Yeah, he had a lot. He was a good friend of mine, and all of his family were a good friend of mine and still are. He was kind of somehow like a visionary, and he was one of the first ones to put together like a really complete programs for race drivers. And I think, Schumacher started, and maybe Senna and Schumacher, they've started that sort of fitness side. But then I think Aki has brought a lot of other aspects in terms of driver training and driver preparation into the Formula One world. And a lot of the stuff that we did, I think we're ahead of time nowadays. Perhaps all the teams are doing similar things, and it's kind of normal how the younger drivers especially are preparing for their careers. But Aki was a bit ahead of his time, I would say. It was interesting stuff. Some stuff were quite complicated, but I think we got some benefits, and Lewis was in that program, and many other drivers obviously were in that program. I think they've all gotten benefit of that.
The one time I came across Aki was about 10 years ago. Maybe it was longer than that, but we ran the Nürburgring Nordschleife together.
Ah, okay.
All 14 miles of it. And Aki must have been, I don't know how old he was, but a lot older than me. And I thought, I've got Aki here. I've got him. There's no... Anyway, that man had an engine on him and real grit and determination. And he was just like a train that wouldn't stop. Anyway, 14 miles later, he looked as fresh as a daisy and I was in bits. But there you go. That's my memory of him. And I just thought, what a solid, determined guy he must have been. And I can see why you racing drivers found him such an inspiration, actually.
Yeah. He was a special kind of guy. And he was very good at digging the performance out of drivers. And he was like more than just a trainer or a physio or a doctor or a mentor or psychologist. He was kind of like, it's hard to find the correct word, but like he was really good at steering the driver, sometimes calming things down a bit if you're getting a bit overexcited or something, and then sometimes pulling the right ropes to just pull you out of a hole. And he was really good at that. I think a lot of he's worked with a lot of different athletes, not just the Formula One drivers, but he's worked with a lot of Olympians and other athletes from other sports. And he's seen a lot. I think he's figured a lot of things that different people are doing, and he was able to like put together a very very comprehensive, very complete program from all kind of aspects from different sports, and taking the good things from different sports and put them together. And that was, I think, one of his sort of special skills that he had.
Was he a good manager as well? Because how did he deal with the intra-team rivalry between you and Lewis? You were both close to him without the sort of politics of the situation influencing the situation.
Yeah, I think he was. And perhaps mine and Lewis's relationship was not that complicated. I think we were always very straightforward. And like I said earlier, perhaps the reason that he was always just a step ahead. He never felt like taking all his tools out of his box to fight. He's done that with a few other drivers, most notably with Rosberg. I think he had to dig deeper and he took more tools out of his box. And perhaps at that point, it would have been more difficult to manage the situation. But anyway, Aki was very good inside the team to get the engineers and the drivers, the team management, to work together, telling them and guiding them how to focus on the right things, not things that are not so important. There's always a lot of problems in many aspects of racing. He was able to guide everyone in the team in the correct direction and in the direction matters, the things that matters. And I think that was where he was very good at.
Now let's talk about your day of days, that victory in Hungary 2008.
Into his final few corners then for Heikki Kovalainen. This extraordinary Hungaroring circuit delivers up its seventh different winner in 7 years. Heikki Kovalainen wins the Hungarian Grand Prix, his first ever Grand Prix victory. I'm sure there'll be plenty more, but what an extraordinary Grand Prix.
Can you just describe what it was like to win the race and why did it feel, or if it did, why did it feel different to winning a race in any other category?
Yeah, I mean, it was, first of all, a race that I probably shouldn't have won. I think probably a podium, a third, would have been the result that my performance that day deserved. I think Massa was going to win the race. Lewis was going to finish second and I was going to finish third. It looked like that. But I remember all weekend, Lewis had more front tire wear. He was harder on his front tire for some reason that weekend. And in fact, he was on a different strategy. He was on a three-stop strategy and I was on a two-stop strategy. And he still wore his left front tire out and his left front tire exploded for a few laps from the end or whatever it was. And then Massa just seemed strong that weekend. And I had no legs performance on him. But three laps from the end, when I entered the main straight, I saw a car on the right side with the smoke coming from the engine. At first, I thought it was a Toro Rosso. I think I was about to lap a Toro Rosso or something. And then when I went past the car, I saw, wow, that was it looked like a Ferrari and must be Massa. And then my engineer came to me and said, okay, three laps to go. We are leading the race. So steady hands now. And, yeah. But I had plenty of margin behind me. I think there was Timo Glock behind me. I don't know, 8 or 10 seconds or something behind me. And there was no rush. So I just brought the car home. And I mean, it didn't feel like a super race. It didn't feel like I deserved necessarily the victory. It didn't feel anything special when I crossed the line. But I remember there's one particular great moment in all of my career when Ron came on the radio and said, welcome to the winner's circle. That was a nice moment. And I wasn't expecting that. Usually my engineer is coming to my radio and congratulating, but then at that point, Ron was coming on the radio and that was a nice feeling. That's probably the best memory from that weekend and from all of my McLaren time, that particular radio call.
Welcome to the world of winning, Heikki. First of many. Well-deserved win. You finish first, you first got to finish. Well done.
It's a funny sport, isn't it? How you win a race that you feel that perhaps you didn't deserve to. Are there races where you felt you drove brilliantly and didn't win, conversely?
Yeah, I think there are more races like that. After my McLaren, Renault and McLaren years, the years with Caterham, Lotus first and then Caterham, I think some of those races I felt I did a better job and I did a race with less mistakes and good in-laps, good out-laps, good race starts and all that, and finishing 17th. that was kind of hard to take, but I feel those years I did better races. I was better race driver at that time. I think the years at McLaren and Renault and the struggles there have taught me a lot of things. And then when I went to Caterham, I think I was able to handle the situation better. And I'm pretty sure had I been in a better car and had the car been faster at that time, I would have been able to do better results compared to what I did with my time, for example, at McLaren. So I just arrived at McLaren a bit early, a bit green, a bit too rookie in many aspects. And I became a better race driver during those years. Just that the team and the car didn't develop enough to kind of get another wave of momentum going. That was the idea after the McLaren years, you know, to go to a smaller team, go back to basics and trying to get myself better frame of mind and get more performance out of myself. And I think I did that initially. But then progress of the team then kind of stalled, and it kind of took me with the ship was sinking, and I kind of went with that.
When you joined Lotus, did you believe it could become a serious challenger?
Initially, no. I thought that the first year will be tough, and kind of knew that starting from scratch is going to be hard. But I didn't think we were going to be 5 seconds off the pace like we were initially. I thought we're going to be a couple of seconds off the pace, and I thought we're going to be at the back of the queue, but we'll be in the queue. But in fact, we were not even able to join the established teams queue, if you like. Only the new teams at the back were racing their own championship. And after the first year, I thought that they were going to make more progress. And then the second year, progress didn't really happen. We got a bit closer, but still not seriously challenging anyone yet. And at that point, it was kind of getting to, I was starting to think like, well, shit, you know, is this going to work out or not? And then the third year already felt like it started to go downhill. The investments were not there. The team needed more push on every area. And in fact, there was just the development was kind of stalling as well. So it started to look a bit worrying.
This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low impact motion. And I don't need to second guess my progress because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout. The Arc uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro Arc, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the Arc. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID. You say the investment wasn't there. How committed was owner Tony Fernandez?
I think at the end, initially, I think he was relatively committed. And I think he thought that it'd be easier to join the queue and get further up the grid. And the first year when things didn't happen, I think that was kind of expected, but the second year I think he was expecting more, and I think when he realized that, you know, spending 100 million plus a year and nothing happening, you know, it kind of, the excitement kind of started to die down a little bit, and I think at that point they probably realized that this might not work out, and then they were starting to scale things back, and at that point it was of course the wrong decision if you wanted to move the team off the grid. So yeah, I think initially I think they were committed, but quite quickly I think they became unsure of that thing.
Did you have anything else on the table for 2010? I mean, in hindsight, was it the wrong call, the wrong decision to go there?
2010, no, not really. It was quite a complicated situation. I just actually gotten into a bit of a management battle with Flavio. Flavio got the penalty or the ban from FIA, if you like, for what happened in Singapore. And at some point, it was in fact at the end of like October 2009, towards the end of 2009 season, when I was told actually by the FIA that I won't be granted a super license if I'm managed by Flavio or his management company. And then at that point, I had an offer from Mike Gascoigne and from Tony. And at that point, it was looking like McLaren was not going to keep me. It was quite obvious. So and they wanted to sign the Lotus deal as soon as possible. But at that point, I kind of like, I got a message from the FIA that, you know, I can't sign that with Flavio. And then, you know, stopped the management contract with Flavio and took things into my own hands and signed with Lotus. And at that point, I thought it was not the, sort of the best move that I could have done. Had I had a slightly better team on table, a more established team, I probably would have gone that way. But I thought starting from the back of the grid with a new team, with some prospects, would be the right thing to do. And initially, I thought when things were starting to move on that these people are serious and this team has got some prospects and it was a good choice. But in the end, it was a wrong choice. And in fact, during the 2010 season, I met with Eric Bullier from Renault, and Renault were interested about the next season, 2011 season. And I met Bullier in Valencia during the Grand Prix weekend, and he said that we'd be interested. But I had a two-year deal with Lotus, and I didn't want to get into other trouble with any contract at that point. So I said to Bullier that I can't do it, although I'd be interested, but I can't do it. And I think at that point I should have gone with Renault and got into a better car. I think I would have been in a better place myself, and I would have been able to perform better. But I didn't want to get into another legal battle, and I didn't do that, and that was probably a mistake.
Do you think if you'd had a bespoke manager behind you at that moment, you would have got yourself in the Renault for 2011 because they would have taken care of the politics and the legal side of it?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, at that point, we were doing everything with myself and my wife, and I was battling with Flavio a couple of years, in fact, in the court. And I think actually one of the biggest mistakes for my career was to leave Flavio's management company. I think they did the best contracts for me in Formula One. And they, in fact, looked after me since the Renault junior years. I signed with Flavio in 2002. And when I signed my first test driver contract, Flavio was able to jump a couple of steps on the payment schedule. And he got me more money. Of course, he took a slice of it, but he got me more money than I deserved as a test driver. And my race driver contracts, they were all always better than the initial Flavio contract said. And I should have just, I mean, like other drivers like Fernando and Mark, of course, they had contracts in place for 2010. So for them, perhaps the decision to stick with Flavio was easier. But in hindsight, I should have stuck to Flavio, and I think he would have been able to get me a great contract, and he would have been able to negotiate me a better throughout the years. And that's one big regret that I stopped the contract.
Heikki, I'm siding with you because if the FIA have told you you won't get a super license if you're with Flavio Briatore, that leaves you in a particularly difficult place, doesn't it?
It was, yeah. And I remember it was also part of the, it's not the reason, but perhaps part of the reason. It certainly didn't help the second half of 2009 season with McLaren. This thing was going on the background. And I remember we had a morning briefing at Suzuka Saturday. We were preparing for the third practice and for qualifying. And after the morning briefing, I walked into the FIA office and I met with Alan Donnelly in the office in the middle of a race weekend. And I asked him the question, Alan, what do I need to do? If I stick with Flavio, you know, can I sign with Lotus? And he said very clearly to me, no, you won't be granted the super license. And it's as simple as that. And, you know, at that point, it was a tough place for me to be. And then in the end, I decided to take things to my own hands and stop the contract with Flavio. And I never had any problems with Flavio. I always liked him as my manager. And the people that were running his company day to day, Bruno Michel, Matthew Michel, they did great deals for me. They looked after me very well. They weren't very welcome at McLaren. They weren't very friendly with the Flavio. It's kind of the Flavio gang wasn't that friendly with Ron gang. But I think, that wasn't the game changer. That wasn't the reason. I think they looked after me very well. And they kept my side of the things always very well. And then actually, once I stopped the contract with Flavio, the next couple of years, when we were doing things with my wife, just me and my wife, you know, we actually thought that, yeah, we need someone else. We need someone here to help us to move things forward. And at that point, we were considering, I met Mika Häkkinen and Didier Cotton. I met them at Singapore through the Singapore Grand Prix. I think it was 2000 and whatever it was. Was it 2011, perhaps? And I was kind of sniffing around that, you know, once this Flavio case is finished, you know, I didn't want to have another manager while I was still having this fight with Flavio. But once that is settled one way or the other for the future, would they be interested to look after me? And in fact, they were. And Mika was very interested too, and he thought he could bring something to the table and he could be of help. But then, for whatever reason, it didn't happen. It kind of like that chat kind of stalled. And eventually, actually, I took an American management company, IMG, and they were managing me for 1 year, the 2012 season. And that was perhaps another mistake. And in fact, I think my relationship with Mika has, you know, during those times, I feel that Mika perhaps felt a bit let down, if you like. Like, I probably didn't communicate with him very well. And kind of like, then when I took the IMG, I think Mika was a bit surprised, and our relationship has never been the same since then, I feel, which is a shame. You know, I respect Mika a lot, and it's a shame that on this management side, there's been quite a lot of things that have gone wrong, almost accidentally. You know, it's not been a purpose. I've always tried to do the right thing, but I've been in quite a difficult place many times, and I've tried to do the right thing, and perhaps I've done the wrong thing at the first place with Flavio. And had I not done that, then the rest of the story would have been more straightforward. But
fascinating.
Yeah. I think I needed those 2 years at McLaren opened a lot of eyes for myself in terms of my own performance and what I need to improve and what I need to focus on the race weekends. And I think when I went to Lotus the first year, 2010, I think I was a better race driver. And after the first year at Lotus, I think I was handling the Grand Prix weekend very well. And at that point, I needed the management to be there sorting the rest of the things out, and that wasn't there. And I think that was one big puzzle that was missing from that kind of comeback plan that I had, if you like.
Yeah, because you were wasting energy, I suppose, on contracts and things when you needed to be focusing on the driving.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say like how much that affected. And I don't want to make an excuse. I think during the McLaren years, even if I had the best managers on my background, and I think, you know, the McLaren team, many times people say that the McLaren, they were favoring Lewis and he was number one. But I mean, he was just a tiny bit quicker. I think it's as simple as that. He just had the edge and I just had to stretch and I just quite couldn't hang on to him enough to be a serious threat and to be grounded another year there. I think it's as simple as that. But if I then, after that phase of my career, if the things on the background had been in place, I think the sort of the second half of my career, Formula One career, if you like, that could be and could have been quite different. And I felt that, you know, when I had to stop from Formula One, I was quite disappointed because I felt at that point the performances were much stronger. And I felt, shit, you know, I think I'm in control of this situation now, but things are just stalling around me. It was frustrating.
It's not fair to say how did McLaren and Lotus compare, because I'm just guessing it was such a big gulf. But perhaps a better question is to say, how did McLaren and Renault compare as teams and environments to go racing?
There were less differences than people think. I mean, many people always thought about McLaren that it's quite a strict environment and quite sort of Ron-like, if you like. Ron is a particular person, and I mean, he was a particular kind of leader and all that, but they both are very much racing-driven teams. Ron was always saying that, you know, any other business that their company are doing are irrelevant if the racing side doesn't work. And Renault was always the same, that, you know, they were willing to take risks and extreme design concepts and push things beyond the limits to achieve some edge over the others. And they were both great race teams. They were very, they had some strong-minded people, some very clever people. The McLaren facility at Woking was better. It was state-of-art. And the Enstone was a bit more old-style, but they had a lot of similarities, in fact. They were less different than many people think. And Pat Simmons running the technical side of Renault, He was very, very much of a racing kind of guy, very switched on, very not conservative, very, very aggressive in many ways. Flavio was aggressive in different kind of way, but the positive way, he was the figurehead, the leader. But both teams had strong leaders in Flavio and in Ron, and the technical team were both aggressive. And I think for a driver, they were both great teams to be involved. In fact, only when I went to Lotus and started a new team, smaller facility, I realized that shit, you know, things that I complained at McLaren and Renault weren't actually that bad.
It was interesting. When you started racing for Renault in 2007, you were replacing Fernando Alonso, who'd gone to McLaren. And Flavio said something I thought really interesting at the start of that year, in that he said, in Kovalainen, I hope to find the anti-Alonso.
Yeah.
And I still to this day don't really know what he meant by that.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, up to that point.
I mean, the fact that he's using you and Alonso in the same sentence makes me think he was putting a little bit of pressure on you. Did you feel that?
Yeah, I felt pressure. And of course, jumping into the two-time world champion's car as a rookie year, he just won the championship. You know, it was, I can't, even at that point, I probably didn't really appreciate the challenge. You know, I kind of thought that, you know, I'm ready, you know, I'm a young driver, I've passed all these young, you know, the junior categories, and, you know, I'm the next big thing. And you know, Melbourne was quite a tough landing for me when I went there, and, you know, just completely out of control a weekend and wasn't able to focus on the right things. And it was a wake-up call. But at that point, in fact, the guy that was guiding me the best was Pat Simmons there. Flavio was, of course, telling me to push and telling the engineers, tell him to push. And, you know, but that wasn't kind of the right guidance that I needed at that point. And he was just giving a little bit of pressure. The Pat Simmons was the guy that was guiding me the best. And my engineering team were guiding me very well. Eventually, I found my feet. I'm sure Flavio saw a lot of potential in me all the way through the junior years. I've been ticking the boxes every year, winning races and winning championships up to the point when I became a test driver, and he'd invested in my career and his management company invested in my career. So, of course, they had high hopes, I'm sure, and they saw a lot of potential. Maybe the reason he was talking about anti-Alonso, maybe he thought that I could be up there, you know, fighting and stopping Fernando winning or trying to fight for him, fight with him at the top. I'm sure that's how they felt up to that point.
You're actually in a unique position in that whilst Renault test driver in 2006, and I think you did nearly 30,000 kilometres of testing that year or something. It was huge, wasn't it? But
yeah,
you worked in the world champion team alongside Fernando Alonso. And then, of course, the next year you're with Lewis Hamilton. So I'd love you just to give me your thoughts on Fernando as a racing driver, as a person, relative to Lewis, really.
Yeah, they were obviously both extremely fast drivers. You know, I remember always those days we had a separate test teams, and I was usually driving for 3 days the other car, and then Fernando and Fizzy were altering the other car. And in fact, quite often I had some really good programs. I had 22 sets of new tires for the day, and Fernando was doing some front wing comparison or some engine reliability testing or something. So my times quite often looked quite good, and I probably didn't appreciate it. I probably didn't look the data carefully enough to really see the truth, because many times I felt my lap times were really competitive compared to Fernando or compared to Fizzy. But I'd kind of forgotten the fact that he had 4 sets of tires and I had 22 sets of soft tires.
You're not exaggerating. Did you really have 22 sets of tires?
I think probably not exaggerating much, at
Amazing.
Least.
Amazing.
I've done some big tire testing days, and the short runs were always the interesting ones, you know, and they're all pretty good tires. They're not all perfect tires, but some tires really good, and, you know, bit of extra revs from the engine for the performance runs, and things always looked quite good. In terms of personalities and in terms of like race drivers, they both obviously extremely fast, and they're both very good at working with the engineering team, and in fact the whole team, in fact the people at the factory, and they like both very active in giving feedback to the factory. And perhaps something that I overlooked also during my career, sometimes I wasn't that bothered about if some button wasn't in the right place or if it wasn't in a perfect place in the steering wheel. And for example, in some cases, I remember we arrived at the test and the brake balance adjuster at that, those days was still a kind of manual adjuster. It'd been shifted to the other side of the cockpit. And I was surprised at what's happened here. This is how Lewis wanted it to be changed to the other side. So we wanted to change both cars so we have the same spares and stuff. And that kind of things happen where, you know, I never thought about that kind of things. In fact, it was not a bad change. It was a good change, but I'd never thought about it. I thought it's been designed to put there and it's kind of there and I can manage with it. But they were both that kind of guys that got into these kind of small details. Some small buttons got changed and they actually then made sense most of the time. They're both really good at that. I think the attention to detail, the ability to work with not just the race engineer or the engineering team at the track, but also the ability to work with the designers at the factory have given them edge over the years. They've gotten exactly the kind of areas that are lacking in the car for them. They've gotten them working that way.
Who was better under pressure? Because you saw both of them, you know, in the midst of a world championship fight. You know, you saw Fernando, okay, he clinched it in Brazil. It wasn't the last race of the year in 2006. And then, of course, you saw Brazil in 2008 with Lewis. Who was sort of dealing with that pressure the best?
It's very hard to say. They both were dealing it very well. I'd say that Fernando, all the way through his career, and I mean, certainly the time that I was with him, he was perhaps more ruthless. You know, he would always take things to the edge and he would perhaps play more sort of silly mind games compared to Lewis. When Lewis was younger, he was also doing that a little bit. He's certainly over the years, Lewis have gotten, perhaps he's more confident in his just sheer speed nowadays and he can finish second one day if, you know, takes too much of a risk to try to win the race. But I'd say that Fernando has always been, and when I was with him as a test driver, he was always very aggressive, very ruthless, and he was very direct with his feedback with the team and kind of more like a Latino type of personality. Lewis was always more polite, even when he wasn't happy with things, when he needed some changes. He was still able to do it more politely. Fernando was more direct, kind of. And perhaps it's coming from the background, you know. Lewis had been with McLaren and with Ron for years, and you could kind of see a bit of the Ron kind of behavior in Lewis, and you could see kind of a bit of Flavio behavior in Fernando. But I think it's very hard to compare which one was better under pressure. I think they both were really good, really excellent. I wouldn't want to say which was better. I think it's not probably fair to compare.
This episode is sponsored by Hydro. Have you ever finished a workout and wondered if it's actually making a difference? I know I have, and that's why I'm delighted to be partnering with Hydro to talk about their newest rower, the Hydro Arc. I love it, and I'm sure you will too. Having this rower at home makes all the difference when I'm back between races, and I'm actually having to fight for time on it as the whole family loves it as much as I do. My son's just completed his first Ironman triathlon, and he totally sees the benefits as well. In just 20 minutes, we can all get a full body workout, arms, legs, and core, so I'm hitting 86% of my muscles in one smooth, low impact motion. And I don't need to second guess my progress because the Hydrometrics tracking system logs my power, endurance, and precision every time I row. One of its standout features is the built-in rotating screen. You can pick from a huge range of classes and row along with Olympians and athletes in some of the most stunning locations around the world. And if I need to stretch or do core work, I just flip the screen and follow along with one of their instructors for a floor workout. The Arc uses your stats to suggest workouts that will help you with your goals. And it comes with a 30-day risk-free trial, free standard shipping, and a one-year warranty. And there's really nothing left to do but get rowing. Skip the gym, not the workout. Stay on track with the new Hydro Arc, Hydro's most advanced rower yet. For a limited time, go to hydro.com and use the code GRID to get $100 off any Hydro rower, including the Arc. That's Hydro, HYDROW.com, code GRID.
Want to try a free sample of berry pie?
Oh, yeah, I do. Wait, time to consult the online experts.
One bite will destroy your body.
Stop it!
They don't know your body. Only you do. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
Can you see why it didn't work with them in the same team?
Yeah, I can absolutely see why it didn't work with them. I mean, they were, first of all, they were so close on performance that they were always near each other on the circuit. And then I think this kind of Flavio style and Ron style was clashing in all aspects of race weekend and any particular race. It was kind of clashing quite easily. They both had, kind of killer instinct. It's the fight for win, and the need to beat each other was too great. So it was quite easy to see that situation could escalate, and it did.
Coming back to you, there are various pivotal moments, aren't there, in a racing driver's career, and weirdly, given the success you had in circuit racing in the junior formulas, do you think one of the things that sealed the deal with Renault for you was winning the Race of Champions in 2004, beating Michael Schumacher? Did that, I remember that result, there was a lot of buzz about you after that. Did that help in any way?
I'm sure it did. At that point, I was very unknown junior driver in some junior program with Renault doing something. In fact, I got chosen to be part of that race because the usual guns in Finland, Kimi or Mika, or both Mikas, in fact, Salo or Häkkinen, or no one else was available or were not interested to do. So I was eventually the one in the line who said, yeah, I'd happily do it. And it was funny weekend. Already during the practice day, one of the marshals came to me after the day. There was like a lot of, I don't know if they're paid or volunteers, but one of the French guy came to me who was timing things, and he came to me and said, by the way, you've been the fastest in every car that you've been testing. We did like a practice run on each different type of cars that they had. He came to me and said, by the way, you're quickest in all of the cars, every car. And I was like, okay.
Did that surprise you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first time that I met many of these guys, you know, I was in the same changing room with Michael, with Sebastian Loeb, with Sean Alesi, with David Coulthard. They had no idea who I was. Obviously, I knew all of them, and I was just almost not, I wasn't asking autographs, but almost like kind of, you know, hanging with the big boys. And then I think I went and I beat Alesi, I beat Coulthard. I think then I beat Michael in a Ferrari. That was quite funny. Yeah. I mean, so unexpected. It's a great moment when I won that race. I couldn't believe it, and it's probably what the rock stars feel every time they have a big concert, you know, step out of the car on the roof and the whole Stade de France cheering. They're looking, who is this kid? And then I went to super final with Sebastian Loeb, and I beat him in a rally car. And that was funny. And
now you're finished though.
Yeah.
Finns can do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I've always felt that I've been able to adapt to different kind of cars. I mean, I've done a bit of rallying in my career, and I've always felt it hasn't been like so difficult to change to cars. I always felt like any kind of car or bike or whatever, I get hang of it relatively well pretty quickly. And I'm sure that helped. I remember Flavio, he called me after the event. Pat Simmons also talked to me after the event, and they all congratulated me, and the whole Renault team, they were so happy about it. I didn't think it was going to be such a big thing, but I think, like you said, it had a very positive, reasonably big impact in my career. Another funny story. After the race, we went back to Paris to the center. We stayed in the George Sank Hotel, very fancy hotel in the middle of Paris. And we gotten into a lift, and Jean Todt, he was the boss of Ferrari at that time, he got to the same lift, and he kind of looked at me a little bit first, and then he asked me, what was your name again? I said, my name is Heikki Kovalainen, by the way. Nice to meet you. And it's probably first time I got some attention, some real attention from some big names in motorsport. And I'm sure it did a lot of good for my career, although it was not an important event. It wasn't an event that I was even planning to do until I got invited, but it had a positive impact.
I'm sure it did, and I'm sure Schumacher mentioned you to Jean Todt, hence the moment in the lift.
Yeah.
Look at the reaction you got from Pat, look at the reaction you got from Flavio, you know, that could have been the launch pad, couldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure it probably was. You know, at that time, there were still quite a few drivers in the Renault Junior program, and I don't think I was standing out that much from the guys that were still there. I can't remember exactly who were there, but there were some good drivers still in the program. And perhaps that was one of the things that really caught the attention of Flavio. I think Flavio was really key to my career at that point. And maybe that was a kind of pivotal moment. And he thought, damn, you know, this guy, maybe this is the one that we need to keep an eye on out of all the young drivers that they have.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, look, Heikki, when you look back, what was it? It was 111 races, wasn't it, in Formula One. What was your best race? I've got this feeling you're not going to say Hungary 2008.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's the only win. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, I won a Grand Prix and yeah, it's great. But like I said, I didn't think in terms of performance it was outstanding. I thought towards the end of 2008, I had some really good races. For example, the race at Fuji, I had a gearbox failure there, but I think I could have won that race. I think there was Alonso and Kubica in front of me. Lewis and Massa, they had an accident on the first lap. And I mean, I think I would have been riding that fight there. And then, like I said, some of the races that I did with Caterham, I think Suzuka 2011 or 12. And then also Abu Dhabi in 2011 or 12. I can't remember whichever race, but Timo Glock was behind me in Virgin or Marussia, whatever it was called at that point. I remember that particular race. I was able to extend the gap 10th by 10th. You know, every lap and no mistakes, and we had good pit stops, good in laps, good out laps. I think it's the best race is coming from that part of my career. I don't think it was the victory in Hungary or some other races before that. I think it's one of those races where I finished 17th. I think they're one of the good ones. And had I had a better car, I believe I could have been fighting right near the front.
What is it about Finns and sim racing? I just want to ask you this question before you go, because we're all on shutdown at the minute. We're wondering when Formula One is going to start again. And a lot of drivers are doing this sim racing now. Not Kimi Raikkonen, not Valtteri Bottas, as far as I can make out, not Heikki Kovalainen. What is it about the Finns? You just like getting out there and doing it for real, don't you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think Kimi has never been a massive fan of any simulators, even in his Formula One teams. He's never been that keen to actually get on the sims, and maybe only when the team have really ordered him to do a few laps, he's turned up. Perhaps, I mean, at least my feeling, and I mean, I haven't done sim racing. I think I'm going to do a little bit this summer.
Oh my God, shock, horror. Wait, hold the front page. What's happening? You're getting a sim.
Yeah, I've got a sim, in fact, coming, quite a good one. With the proper, it's got some motion platform and some big screens and all that. It's coming, and I'm going to try a little bit. I'm going to do some stuff. I mean, I'm getting old, so I'm going to get rusty too quickly, I think. So I need to do something.
I'm worried. Is the internet good enough in Northern Finland?
Hopefully, yeah. I mean, I've got a great sim coming, and the internet connection might be letting me down. But I mean, then I need a digger and a fiber optic the size of my forearm to be dug on the ground, then I think eventually we'll solve that as well. But, you know, at least my experience from the simulators so far in my career has been that they're good tools, but they've not been able to replicate and they've not been able to simulate the real deal, if you like, well enough. I don't think the sims have been as good as, for example, in the airplane industry. I think they are very useful, and you can get kind of very similar feel that you're flying the real plane. And it's very difficult to get that kind of feel in the race car. And I think Kimi, certainly, I don't know Valtteri, but Kimi at least, I'm guessing that the reason he's not that keen on them is if he feels that they are not so relevant. They might be relevant, but they're not so realistic and like not good enough tools yet. And my feeling has been a bit similar throughout my career. I did a lot of sim work at McLaren, and I did a lot of sim work also at Caterham eventually when they got the sim. But it was hard to take some real differences in the sim that I felt. It was hard to take them to the race circuit or get the same feel at the race circuit. So it was more useful for circuit familiarization and that kind of stuff. But to get some real work done in the sim, it's very difficult in the racing world. I think I haven't, you know, I haven't driven the latest F1 sim. I don't know how good they are now. And I'm getting a good one here. It's not an F1 sim that I'm getting, but I'm getting a reasonably good one here. So I'll figure out if they are anywhere near.
I hope we're going to see you racing Charles Leclerc. He's winning everything at that.
Yeah, I don't know. I need to practice a little bit and see what kind of lap times are happening. If they're anywhere near, then I could think about it. If they're too slow, then I won't turn up. So if I turn up, I want to be at least reasonably competitive. I don't want to do what Johnny Herbert and cut the first corner and go from 16 to first and then be disqualified.
You know, always competitive, Fakie, aren't you? Always competitive. Quickly, how's life treating you in Japan? Are you enjoying the Super GT out there? Are you enjoying living out? Where are you in Tokyo?
Yeah, when I'm in Japan, I'm staying in Tokyo. I stay actually quite a lot of the year there. Obviously, this year is a bit unknown. We will see when the season starts. At the moment, we have a provisional calendar starting in July, but we'll obviously monitor the situation. I'm a bit skeptical about that, whether it will start in July or the season. But I think I'm settled in very well. In fact, I'm quite happy that I've been able to move on from my Formula One days. Like I said, you know, I wasn't planning to stop in Formula One when it did stop. And it was tough to take first, but then I'm glad I've been able to move on. I found a good family there with Toyota, Desart Racing. I've been working with them now over the years. We won race, apart from the first year, we won a race at least every year. And we won the championship in 16. And I've enjoyed racing there. The cars are actually quite a nice GT cars. They've got quite a good grip for a GT car. The power could be more, but the chassis are very nice. Circuits are nice. The Japanese fans are maybe one of the best in the world. There's a lot of followers coming to see the races. And working with Toyota has been straightforward. I've enjoyed being there. And it's kind of like third part of my professional career. First, there was the Renault and McLaren. Was, if you like, the first phase. And then the Caterham Lotus, bit of a chaos, and then now more settled with the Toyota. And yeah, I've enjoyed there, and I'm still very motivated to race. I'll keep racing until I feel motivated, until I feel it's the right thing to do, and it's something that also keeps me motivated, keeping my fitness and my training regime going. And so far, so good. I think it's not a bad place for me to be, but I go year by year, and then at some point, perhaps it's time to do something different, but at the moment, at least, I'm enjoying it, and I'll keep doing it until that enjoyment stays, I think.
Do you enjoy life in Japan, the pace of life? It's very different, isn't it, to the European way?
Yeah, it's very different, and it's in fact a very big contrast. Staying here in Lapland, in the middle of forest, I've got only one neighbor. In fact, a Finnish guy who is running a Moto2 and Moto3 team, Aki Ayo, he's my neighbor here, and he's also... he's the only one that is around here. So we've been able to hang out a little bit, although keeping a bit of distance, no handshaking or anything with him. But it's very quiet here. And then in contrast, the center of Tokyo is like the busiest place in the world almost. And every now and then I need the break from Tokyo. But in principle, I've enjoyed life there. Tokyo is a very international city. It's not as Japanese as perhaps outside of Tokyo, where it's difficult to manage without the language skills and the sort of the Japanese way of life. But Tokyo is very international, and there are a few foreign guys out there as well, a few race drivers that we can hang out and do things together. So I enjoy life there, and the moment and the day that I don't enjoy, then I gotta stop going there and go somewhere else.
Well, Heikki, good luck with everything that comes in the Super GTs, and thank you for a most wonderful chat reflecting on all things Formula One. I've loved it. It's been really interesting, and I've learned loads.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me in your show. It's you've done some great podcasts. I've listened to most of them, and you've had some interesting guys to chat. And yeah, I hope giving you a small insight what's sort of been going on, and glad if you've enjoyed it, and if the listeners have enjoyed it as well.
Great stuff. Thank you, Heikki. Good to speak.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Thanks, Heikki. What a fascinating chat. No excuses, just honesty and reflection. I think a lot of young drivers could learn from Heikki's experiences, because careers can turn on a dime in this sport. And it's so important to remain ahead of the curve in everything that you do, both on and off the racetrack. It's hard to pick a favourite bit of what Heikki had to say. There was a little bit of gold dust all the way through. His memory of events is astounding. And in particular, I love the recollections of his time at McLaren, of being alongside Lewis Hamilton in the same team. And that bet with Lewis about who'd be flat out through Eau Rouge on lap one of practice at the Belgian Grand Prix was amazing. Stories like that is what this podcast is all about. Thanks, Heikki, for your time. It was great to catch up, and good luck with your racing in Japan whenever the race season over there gets going again. Right, it's time to dig into the virtual mailbag and see what you guys have been saying about the show. First, here's a note about last week's episode with Racing Point's technical director, Andrew Green. I've been a fan of Racing Point ever since Mr. Mallier bought the team, says Soen Blomik. This podcast helped me understand the mentality of this team, and that has made me fall in love with the team even more. Thanks for bringing us this podcast. Well, what a lovely note, Soen. Thank you. And I have to agree that Andrew was a sensational guest. Looking through the mailbag, it's also fun to find out how you guys listen to Beyond the Grid. Pierre Mayo in Montreal got in touch to say this. I always wait to have 5 or 6 episodes in the queue before listening to Beyond the Grid. But each time I wish I had more to listen to. And in 2 weeks, I would have attended my 43rd Grand Prix. 40 of them in Montreal, one in Watkins Glen in 1979, and one in Magny-Cours in 1993. Now, I know there's a chance you're not going to hear this message for 5 weeks, Pierre, but thank you. And what a tally of races you've watched over the years. You're a true F1 fan. Well, that's it for another episode, but of course, we'll be back next week with another big name from Formula One. In the meantime, if you want to drop me a message about the show and potentially get a shout out on here, I'm at TomClarksonF1 on Twitter, or you can use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid. Please keep your messages coming. We read them all and love hearing what you have to say. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for listening. And as ever, Beyond the Grid is produced by F1 in association with Audioboom. Until next time, keep it flat out.